Blog Talk Radio.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man. You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the Memphis State. Let's go hook him up!
Team Challenge Series of Over the Top Radio. I am your host, Ed, in San Antonio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Katrer. So what's going on, Katrer?
If the Team Challenge Series version, that means it's going to suck?
No, it means it's going to be awesome. Team Challenge Series is one of the greatest wrestling events in the history of wrestling that culminated with the greatest victory as Jake Middleman, what the fuck was his name? Milkman Middleman, who ascended the won the battle royal and won $1 million, and then his teammates wouldn't let him share or talk in the interview.
And then Larry Zbysko stole the money. At least that's what they said in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and he didn't give nobody the money.
Yeah, and
but he didn't matter. He didn't have to see him again with, because after that he left. And the company went downhill. So.
Yeah, the company pretty much, I mean, that was pretty much it for the AWA by that time.
This was in like 1990, I believe.
Yeah.
I remember reading a big article in PWI that they had stripped the world AWA the world title recognition. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I actually do.
That was a big deal.
That was almost, that was even worse than when my home city territory was the first territory to lose its spot in the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Top 10s, and Southwest was the first one to lose its recognition by the After Mags. It's just tonight, everyone, it's just me and Katrer, because Craig is out seeing some dude he's seen perform like 100 times before tonight. And last year he was like, let's talk about moving the show, but then he never talks about it. So I always forget until like the day of the show, and then I'm like, oh, fuck, there's no Craig tonight.
He wouldn't have been no help on the AWA anymore. So.
Yeah, well, that's kind of why I decided we should do this topic, because I knew we could talk about it. And he, you know, Craig, he just doesn't know about the history like we do, because we've just been watching wrestling, or we had a wider variety of wrestling than he did for a longer time growing up. And
mainly this came up because Bernie Kanye died this week. Everybody knows that. So
yeah, and it's actually a sad story when it comes down to the end, because you know the dude pretty much had dementia. And I don't know how aware
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's. And I don't know how much he was aware of everything that was going around. In fact, he even accidentally, because I don't think he did it. I really don't know, was it there, but he killed an elderly gentleman at the rest home that he was at by body slamming the guy. And then he had to leave, and I guess they took care of him privately. But yeah, it's kind of sad, you know. I mean, when you're like this person who's like, you know, like a great person who's done, and then he was a great athlete. I mean, he almost went to the Olympics, you know what I mean, and then they deteriorate into, you know, kind of, it's almost, I will say, almost as bad as like Muhammad Ali, you know what I mean? You know, because that, you know, seeing Muhammad Ali is like the greatest boxer of all time, speaking of boxing with the big fight coming on. I mean, Mayweather Pacquiao ain't got shit on Muhammad Ali, but it's, honestly, it's very sad and depressing to see Muhammad Ali. You know what I mean? So,
and, you know, I read the Observer last week, and Nick Bockman was going through the same thing.
Yeah, that's another sad thing because, you know, it wasn't that long ago where he did interviews, and he was so coherent and sounded so good for being an older person. And in a matter of years, the mind is deteriorating, you know what I mean? And it's getting like that.
I think they've said in the Observer, like, they had the Cauliflower Alley, and he's being honored, and they hit him up on stage. He didn't know why he's up there, you know?
Wow.
Well, everybody was honoring him.
That's
a horrible disease. I've had family members go through that. I feel better if they just, you know, if you just lose them and have to, if they just pass away, then have to go through that ordeal. That's horrible. I mean, I know who you are. You love ones.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But luckily, I've never known anyone like that. But, yeah, I can imagine that would suck. And Nick Bockwinkel, I mean, I saw.
He's one of the smartest, like the most intelligent, you know, learned people in the business for all those years. So.
Pitcher Ric Flair. But instead, you know, being Ric Flair, but being super, super intelligent. That was what Nick Bockwinkel was, pretty much. He wasn't as flamboyant as far as, like, the women and the shouting and being crazy, crazy, but he was dressed just the same way. He spoke like he was a professor almost, real smooth. He was a great talker. And
I'm
not sure
where he wasn't at. He didn't come off a lot of times as a heel when he was a heel because he spoke so intelligently and smart.
Yeah. But I will say, as far as he is the smoothest, oldest worker that I ever saw. I mean, his last run was what? He was in his mid-50s. And the dude was smooth. I mean, the dude really was a great fucking worker. I don't think people of this generation even know or give him credit. But he was pretty damn good. Even when he was old, I mean, the dude could.
Yeah, I mean, that last series he had with Nick Bockwinkel, I remember watching like a 60-minute draw on ESPN, like on New Year's Eve or something, from Las Vegas. They had a 60-minute draw, and they had an awesome match.
Yeah. Yeah, and then like if you get that Wrestling Go DVDs, he's got like an awesome match where he carries like a rookie, Terry Allen, Magnum TA, and made him look like $1 million. He was even... There's a match where it's Nick Bockwinkel versus Bruiser Brody with Lou Dez as a referee, and fucking Brody's working. You know, there's only a few people Brody would actually work for and not just brawl, you know, and then Nick was one of them, but he was bad.
He and Ric Flair, I look back at Iggy and Ric Flair, they were probably like the two best examples of world champions, you know, professional wrestling world heavyweight champions. You know, they carried themselves like champions. They were great wrestlers. They were professional. I mean, Flair would be—he's way more flamboyant, but I mean, he's always dressed to the nines, you know, in the suit and everything like that. And Bockwinkel was the same way, so.
Yeah, and he had, and when he was younger, he had some early play. Hold on, what's about to be? Sorry, excuse me. Did you ever see the Monkees that he was on? Do you remember the Monkees?
The Monkees. Oh,
they were like
the TV show.
Yeah, they were like...
I remember the Monkees TV show. I watched that when I was younger. I think it was on Nickelodeon or something.
Yeah, he came out on the Monkees, and he was awesome on the Monkees. I remember that. He was great, man. But to get back to talk more about Vern, Vern was actually, like I said, he was an amateur wrestler, and he was like a couple-time national champion and was supposed to go to the Olympics, but unfortunately, I think at the time they only took one person in the weight division, and the one dude who was in his weight division was just like the best, and he couldn't beat the guy, so he was an alternate. But he probably would have won the silver had he been in it against the guy, and he probably would have won gold if the other guy wasn't in it. But then he came into pro wrestling, and he was considered a good-looking guy at the time. To me, he just was an average guy. I mean, he was already kind of going bald at a young age. But just like Balkweger, he was real smooth. He was a great worker. And he was around at the perfect time because his prime was basically the golden age of wrestling on TV.
Yeah.
And everybody watched wrestling, and probably everyone believed wrestling was real, to the point where he was the star of that TV show where he was like the television champion, and he was more recognized and more more people recognized him because of the TV than they recognized Lou Thesz as the NWA champion just because of the TV.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that didn't sit well with the NWA, and they just didn't prefer him, and this caused issues, and he ended up taking over the Minneapolis territory, and then they issued a challenge against, was it Pat O'Connor, to come and defend the title, and if he doesn't come, and he's too chicken to come wrestle Vern, that they're leaving the NWA, and that's how the AWA was created. And
I think it was something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was something that, I mean, it happened a long, long time ago. But basically, that's how the AWA started, and, like, he kept himself as, he was the owner, the promoter, and the champion. And people, you know, they look down when you're doing all kinds of things, but in reality, he was the perfect person for the job because he was the most famous wrestler at the time, and he was damn good. You know, he just did it for too long. You know what I mean? He did it to
he was in that area. He was, you know, like the hometown guy. He was over. You know.
Yeah. The NWA. It pretty much covered the majority of the United States. You had WWE had the upper northeast corner.
Yeah.
But the NWA had the majority. But the AWA was spotty. But in those spots, it was huge. Like Minneapolis, Chicago, San Francisco, Las Vegas, you know, it wasn't as big as the NWA, but they were big. Milwaukee,
yep.
Indianapolis, but yeah, they were big where they were at, and they had some big draws, and they made money for like a long time. And, you know, he had like, unfortunately, his stars got old because like his biggest stars were himself, Nick Bonkwinkle, Ray Stevens, Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher, and you know, they all wrestled way longer than they should have. Even though Nick was still really good, even when he was old, but like the Bruiser and the Crusher, and I think Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher were awesome. I mean, yes, they couldn't work for shit, but goddamn, best characters. They're two of the best characters of all time.
Oh yeah, the most famous.
Yeah, and, like, I remember, like, the first time I actually got to see the Dick the Bruiser, really, except from, like, little clips here and there, was when he was the referee for the Black Scorpion thing.
Yeah.
And he cut a promo before, and I will say that he was the scariest old man I ever seen in my life. I would have ran more from him than the dozen Black Scorpions. I mean, because he just came off as this badass old man who wasn't going to take no shit and was going to kick your ass and still made you believe he could kick your ass. And the Crusher was almost the same way. He was a little more humorous. You know, he had the big cigar and the beer, and he's always talking about, like, what do they call those songs? Like Rosa Barrow? Polkas?
Yeah,
Polkas. Polkas. And they were, like, just the perfect tag team. They were just perfect. Like old school, you think of a wrestler, you think of the Dick the Bruiser or the Crusher. But they just wrestled till they were like in their 60s and they just got too old. And then the Road Warriors pretty much killed them because they wouldn't sell for the old men, even though they were over like Rover.
Yeah, I remember the Road Warriors won their first world tag team title from him and from the Bruiser. For no, it was the Crusher and the Baron, Baron Von Raschke.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so I think he probably looked 100 years old when he was 10. So.
Yeah, I mean, that dude looked the same for like, he came out of the womb looking like an old man, and he may have grown in height, but he looked the same no matter what, dude.
Hey, he always reminded me of the guy from the original Heels Have Eyes. You know what I'm talking about?
Right? Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about. Yeah. But yeah, like Victor, and then like Victor Bruiser and the Crusher were, they had an awesome feud, especially more the Bruiser with Bobby Heenan. They used to beat the shit out of Bobby Heenan, and that's how Bobby got famous for taking all those famous bumps, because he would sell and he would bleed from the Bruiser like no one. And yeah, they were great. And then, you know, the AWA had like a, it really did, like, I think Dave made the comment, like, the other night on the Jim Cornette interview, where if you just look at the talent from, like, the last year to, I forgot how many years before, but it's like, you know, they had a talent that was neck and neck with NWA and WWE for, like, a long time. Everybody went to the AWA. Ric Flair would go to the AWA. Ric Flair actually started in the AWA. That's another thing we need to talk about. You know, besides being the promoter, the champion, the owner, he was also, like, the trainer. And, of course, he had, like, you know, all the, you know, people helping him train, but he was, like, it was his thing where he would take all these wrestlers to, what, basically his barn in Minnesota,
yeah,
or Minneapolis, and he would run them like hell, not as bad as, like, Bill DeMont, but he'd work their asses off, and then he trained some great guys. I mean, Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, the Iron Sheik, and then after that, the Iron Sheik became one of his trainers. And, you know, as much of a joke as the Iron Sheik is today, you talk to these older wrestlers, and they'll tell you he was a badass when he was young. He was like hell on wheels when he was young. And who else? Brad Ringens, Ken Patera.
Chris Taylor was the Olympian that he had trained. I remember the big guy.
Yeah. I mean, it just,
I mean, just
the whole.
Just if you want to point out too, you know, Flair and Steamboat, two of the best workers of the '80s and some of the '90s too. So,
yeah, and when Ric Flair went to this camp, he was not the Ric Flair that we've known for like years. He was a Ric Flair that was what, 60 pounds heavier, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of stocky, and I know he had dark hair. I basically think I've seen a match with him. You know, before he became the Nature Boy, or, you know, Ric Flair. And he was a big guy, and he was, like, unrecognizable back then.
Yeah, and in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the story goes that Ric Flair quit three different times. I think the first two he quit just out of frustration, but went back. But the third time, he was, like, he was done for sure. So Vern went to his house and took him in the backyard and beat the shit out of him, not like a fist fight, but like stretched him and whatever, and then somehow convinced him to go back and got him to come back. And thank God, because, you know, could you imagine wrestling without Ric Flair? You know what I mean? I couldn't do it. I just, like, Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan, those are the two people that, you know, were wrestling when I was a kid.
And I mean,
up, so
think about if he would just put that title on Hulk Hogan, how different the 80s might have been.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the main reasons Hogan ended up leaving. You know, they wouldn't put the title on him. I mean, he was the most popular wrestler in the company at the time, and he was one of the hottest wrestlers.
They couldn't put the title on him because AWA wasn't his main job. But New Japan was actually his main one, and you know, I don't think he ever really trusted Hogan from the beginning. So it's like, he was kind of in his mind, he knew he couldn't do it. And what if he did do it and Hogan jumped anyway? Because they didn't have guaranteed contracts back then. You know, he could have done the Medusa thing like she did on WCW and went on fucking WWE TV with the AWA title and throw it in the trash. I mean, that wouldn't have been as worse as Stan Hansen running it over with his truck. But, you know what I mean? He could have done that. So, I mean, I can't blame Bonnie for not doing that because he could never really trust Hogan. But who knows what would have happened. You know, maybe they would have even got hotter, and maybe the AWA would have. But I think Vince still would have stole everybody away from him.
And that's where, as much as they want to say Hulkamania started in WWF, started in AWA.
Yeah, because I remember reading about that. It was like right after the Rocky movie and stuff. And, gee, that one thing about the AWA is they had some characters. Like I mean, I talked about Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher, but fucking Mad Dog Vachon, one of the greatest interviews of all time, because he never knew what the hell he was talking about other than he was going to kill you. And it was funny because he was this short dude, but he was this short dude. He was Chris Benoit before Chris Benoit. And when I say that, I mean as little as Chris Benoit was when he came through the curtain, you just knew he was going to kick somebody's ass because he gave that thing. That was the Mad Dog. The Mad Dog came out, and you may have been a foot taller than him and bigger, but my God, you knew he was going to kick that dude's ass. You know what I mean? And he was such a great interviewer. I mean, the Mad Dog was awesome. It was kind of sad seeing him go into the Hall of Fame in Arizona because he kind of did a Larry Zbyszko where he kind of just kept repeating himself and stuff. It was a little sad, but he was awesome.
I still
awesome.
Love the match when Kevin Nash took his foot or his leg.
Yeah, Kevin Nash pulled off his leg to use it as a foreign weapon in a match. And, I'll never forget that. That was pretty funny. And, they had, him, and they had, Bern von Roschke, who was, like the German we were talking about, always goose-stepping and looking like a million years old.
She had not been amazing. It was, the Skandorite bar of that area.
And then one of my favorites from the AWA, and you'll never see anyone like this ever get pushed again, but Jerry the Crusher Blackwell.
He was
5'5", about 500 pounds, and he could throw a drop kick. And
strong, too. They used to do those strength things with him where he'd bend, bars over his head or something like that.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, he was a big dude. I liked Blackwell. He couldn't really do too much.
He could do drop kicks, though. He could get up for drop kicks.
I know. It was amazing. The drop kick was amazing. And then he'd always have, Mad Dog. I remember, I can tell a story I remember from, I have different copies or different, what do you call it, issues of Beyond the Mat. And there's a Beyond the Mat where he's having, the director's having dinner with Jesse Ventura and Mick Foley. Have you seen this one?
Yeah, I actually have that. Maybe
the story is, it's Jesse the Body Ventura. And we'll talk a little more about Jesse in a few minutes. But it was Jesse Ventura and Adrian Adonis, who were the East-West Coast Connection. And they were actually a goddamn great tag team because you got the one dude who could work his ass off and then you got the other dude who could talk like Gary Shue at the time. But they're wrestling the Mad Dog, and I'm not sure who the Mad Dog's partner is. I don't remember if that was brought up in the story, but, the Mad Dog was pretty stiff. And he would beat up Adrian and Jesse. And they were getting tired of it, man. They were just getting tired of getting their ass kicked every night. So one night they decide they're having the brawl, and I think Jesse grabs Mad Dog by the arms in the back to set him up. And Adonis comes with a sure shot, and Adonis just, nowadays you look bad because you don't have all the concussion things, but Adonis basically swung that motherfucking chair as hard as he could, hit Mad Dog so hard that Mad Dog pretty much went out for a few seconds. Literally knocked him out for a few seconds. And then they had the match, and then they got out of Dodge. So the next show, they're there in the dressing room, and here comes the Mad Dog, and he's making a feline right for him, and they're like, oh, fuck, and they're getting their fists clenched because they're getting ready to throw down with the Mad Dog in the locker room because they think he's going to come get his receipt or kick their ass. And the Mad Dog comes up to him, and he's like, yesterday in that match. And he puts his thumbs up, and he does like the okay. He goes, that was magnificent. And he walks away, and they were like, oh, fuck. They're like, we gave him a receipt, and he didn't even know it. But that's just how tough that old man was,
Remember, it was a few weeks ago, I was watching WrestleFest AEA. You remember when WWF had that big show at the Milwaukee Stadium one year outside?
Kind of. I'm sure if you talk more about it, I'll remember more of it.
They had like Andre the Giant against Hulk Hogan in a cage match, the main event or something like that. And they had the Weasel Suit match with the Ultimate Warrior against Bobby Heenan, which
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Which actually started in the AWA when he would face like Bug Zumhoff and or Greg Gagne or somebody. And it was just weird because he was in Milwaukee and they never identified him, but the Crusher was right there at ringside, like during that whole match.
Well, like going back to Jesse, like he pretty much fucked. He was one of the first ones to really fuck over Vern in going to the WWE because he sent him a letter. I think he lied to exactly when he was going. Like I think he said, okay, I'm going here, but then like the Friday before he debuted or something in Madison Square Garden, and Jesse fucked him, but. Yeah, him and Adonis were a great tag team. And it's funny because a lot of people will rag on the AWA because of their tag team champions. But in reality, the High Flyers were a great tag team. It's just that, you know, people always pick on Greg for being, you know, he's pushing his son. And his son, you know, Greg was, you know, he wasn't muscular. He was skinny, but he was a good worker. And Jim Brunzell was fucking awesome, you know. And
yeah,
the High Flyers were actually
still one of the best drop kicks you ever see.
Yeah, they were a great tag team. And
I never thought that Greg got pushed too much. No, like he didn't put the world title on him ever or anything like that.
A lot of people did feel that way though. That's what I don't understand because I feel the same way you do. He was a tag team champion. You know what I mean? He wasn't the world champion. He was never the focal point. Even when it was dying, he was never he was one of the main guys, but he was never the focal point. You know?
And if anybody that has the network. Go to the 2006 Hall of Fame, and he gives one of the greatest speeches. I mean, like the charisma that came out of him during that speech was like incredible. It was one of the best speeches in Hall of Fame history. Greg Gagne was that year. Everybody needs to watch it.
Yeah, that was pretty good. And he was good. I mean, Mike Graham, they get so maligned, and a lot of it's because of their family. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Greg was better than Mike. Mike was a good little worker, but he just had a bigger mind. He just had a bigger mind inside his own mind. But Greg, I never heard those kind of complaints from Greg as far as being wacky like Mike was. But he just for some reason people just want to pick on Greg, and to me, it was always uncalled for.
It was always going to be when the promoter's son, everybody's going to say that.
Yeah.
That's the way it's always going to be. Mike Graham, he was good in the ring, but he didn't have much of a he wasn't much of a talker or anything. He had any kind of a character. Greg Gagne was actually pretty good, speaker.
Yeah,
doing promos and stuff like that. I thought he was very good.
Yeah, he had good promos when he was shooting with Brody.
I remember they called him, I was confused because they called him King Kong Brody in the AWA. You remember that?
Yeah, because they had the Bruiser.
The Bruiser.
I think the Bruiser.
Even
so
when
the
Bruiser was retired,
so
he used the King Kong Brody.
Yeah, so he was King Kong Brody, and he was still hell on wheels, and they had the Road Warriors for a couple years, and they had a good run in the AWA. And then it was so weird because they just killed everybody in the AWA. And then they fucking lost to Jimmy Garvin and Mr. Electricity Steve Regal. I'm not Steve Regal from WWE.
Oh, yeah.
Another
remember
Steve Regal.
That was the first time I ever saw the Road Warriors get beat because they bought they used to have these one-hour videotapes at the video store, the AWA. So they were only other ones other than, WWF you could find. And, I think it was like tag team classics or something, and that match was on there. And I remember watching that.
Yeah. So they had them, and then they'd have like Wahoo and Superstar Billy Graham, and they had all kinds of talent. And then just Vince took everybody, and then Crockett started getting a lot of the good ones, and they just didn't keep up with the times at all.
Vince took a lot, like across the board. He took Hogan, Dr. D. David Schultz, who was there at the time. And then, aside from the wrestlers, he took Bobby Heenan and Gene Oakland. It was like two of the mainstays in AWA.
He took one of the announcers, too. He also took one of the announcers. I can't think of the guy's name, but he took one of the announcers, too. And
He took, I would think, Rod Trungard. Is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah, he came in later in like 88 or something. But yeah, he took a bunch of people from there.
Adonis. Just fucking they took a lot. And it's funny, like, we were going to talk about some of their big cards, and the very first one actually looks like this awesome show. And then you look at the other ones, and it's like, goddamn, how did it drop off from one year to the next? And even the pay-per-view wasn't that great of a show when you really, it had the great, awesome Kerry Von Erich, Gary the King Lawler match, but other than that, it was pretty weak. But let's go over some of these cards, and we'll talk about some of the guys on the cards real quick.
First one would be that Super Clash. In 85?
Yeah, Super Clash in 85, and they drew 21,000 people. And I don't think all the other shows combined even come close to like half of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best AWA shows to me that I saw were with all the stuff, all the guys from the other promotions. From the AWA, This was when they were doing Pro Wrestling USA too?
It might have been. It might have been because Sarge, Sarge was around at that time, and that's when AWA was around the time of that NWA, that whatever it was called. Because there is a lot of people that are not from the AWA on the Super Clash show. I'll just run down the first match. The AWA America's Champ, Sergeant Slaughter. I don't even remember the AWA America's Champ.
I think it was on the title for Sergeant Slaughter because it had the word American and he was America's hero.
since he was coming off of G.I. Joe. So he beat Boris Zhukov, who is just the Russian with the big head. It was mainly like Russian. And a big fucking head is bigger than Tito Ortiz's head.
And I think, when they were in, he was in the NWA, Boris Zhukov was like a, like his private?
He might have been, and then he went Russian.
I think he was like, I can't remember his name, but I think he was with Kernodal and Slaughter. I think maybe he was a private or something like that.
Now that sounds, I can't think of his name though. Fuck. I'm sure we'll remember as soon as the show's over. But he was Jim Nelson.
Jim Nelson, that's right.
Yeah.
And he had the biggest head I've ever seen.
Yeah. He was like Khrushchev. He was a Russian, he wasn't Russian, he was a Russian synthesizer, I guess.
Yeah.
And Slaughter won that match. And the next match was the IWA champion, Mil Máscaras. And he pinned Buddy Roberts, which is kind of a weird match.
And I think I think this was the title he held in the 70s and never lost.
Yeah, the AWA was like an organization for a while, and they actually had some names, and Mill was a champion. He might still be the IWA champion for all I know.
I think the baseball guy, that was the Eddie Einhorn promotion, right?
It's been so long, I can't remember.
I think he was involved with Major League Baseball or something. And then he started his own company.
Yeah, and and Mill was like on all the aftermags for like the longest time. But this is before 85, so this is towards the end.
He might have been on the cover of the first Pro Wrestling Illustrated.
Oh, really? I'd have to go back and look at that.
I think it might have been him and Dusty Rhodes on the cover of the first ever Pro Wrestling Illustrated.
Oh, okay. I used to just love looking, getting the Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and they'd have the two pages where they had like the back issues with all the covers. And I used to just love looking at all the covers.
I went through and looked at that because Pro Wrestling Illustrated actually has a site that it has all the covers, that you can go back and look at. I used to love going through because I would know when the magazine was going to. I'd love when I you know, good day, and you know, at the grocery store, and that we in all three new editions of Pro Wrestling Illustrated, Inside Wrestling, and the rest will be out at the same time. It'd be like Christmas thing.
Right. Yeah. And then the next match, which is a kind of a big match, you got Jumbo Sharuta, Giant Baba, and Tenryu, and they beat Harley Race and Bill and Bill Urn is Wild Bill Urn, or the Goon later in WWE. And Scott Urn was the original Super Destroyer. And he had a big run in Georgia with Superstar against Tommy Rich.
And they also were the Super Destroyers in World Class.
Yeah, they were the Super Destroyers. That's when they started teaming with in World Class. And then he kind of lost his luster because he was great as the Super Destroyer, but then when there was a smaller, not as good Super Destroyer, you know what I mean? It kind of brought it. You couldn't take the team as seriously as you took him because he was a big dude as a Super Destroyer. He ended up dying of brain cancer pretty young, sadly. And
I thought Bill was pretty good.
He was pretty good. I mean, he's the first wrestling champ I ever chanted was Chauncey at Wild Bill Urn.
I remember that at World Class. Everybody was chanting Chauncey at him because
I never understood what it meant or what it was or what. But damn, I sure enjoyed chanting Chauncey at his ass. I didn't start that Chauncey chant, but I remember when he came out in that Legends Battle Royal as the Goon, I just started fucking chanting Chauncey, and I just remember this guy around my age. He just gets this weird look in his face, and he looks at me. That was his name. Shit, that was funny. But Jumbo Sharuto, he was a former AWA champion, and
he got a pretty long run for Japanese guy with that title.
Yeah, usually the Japanese guys have the title when they were on tour or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it'd be like they won it at the beginning of the tour and lost it at the end or something like that, you know. But he kept it for several months before losing to Rick Martel.
Yeah, and he was one of the best Japanese workers of all time. He died kind of young of cancer, too. But Jumbo Sharuto, he was badass. Baba was just a sight to see because he was like the world's tallest Japanese person ever until like recently. He was some of the basketball players.
He looked so strange, too.
Yeah.
He's so weird. You know?
Yeah. And then Tenryu was another great Japanese worker of all time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, Harley Race was awesome. And I'm sure this is actually a good match. I'm trying to think if I ever saw it when I was a kid or not. I'm not too sure. The next match is a match I've seen a bunch of times because they always showed it. It was when Sherry Martel pinned Kenny Devine. It's like everybody beat Kenny Devine for the AWA title, it seemed like.
I don't remember any two other formers came along. It was Jerry Martel and Candy Devine in AWA. It was like Misty Blue Sims and Cat LaRue. You remember?
Yeah, and then when Sherry left, they brought in Medusa, and then like Medusa wrestled Candy Devine, and Candy Devine was always in the AWA. And what's weird is, okay, this match went 11-24, and it was an okay match because Sherry was good. And then you look at the next match, okay, and then you have the world-class Texas champion, Kerry Von Erich, and he pinned Jimmy Garvin. Jimmy Garvin had a great run in the AWA against the Rick Martel before he went to world-class. But this match went 6 minutes and 42 seconds, but Sherry Martel got 11. So I'm assuming Kerry was fucked up. Kerry had a reputation. Kerry did have a reputation where when he went to other territories, he would party. And I remember he went to Missouri and got Geigel, dropped him off at the hotel, and then when he went to pick him up, Kerry was gone. Because Kerry went and got some drugs and decided to go party instead of wrestling on the show. So, yeah, but I'm sure it was this match got a lot of heat. I mean, you know, for all his flaws, though, Kerry Von Erich was fucking, even fucking high as shit, he could still actually go if he had somebody who could general the match. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kerry Von Erich could take a fucking shot of heroin fucking 5 minutes before the match and still have a great match with Ric Flair. You know what I mean? But,
While you were talking there, I just went to YouTube, and I created a new playlist called the AWA, and the entire Superclass show is on this playlist, so if anybody wants to check it out,
go to YouTube.com. I'm going to watch it after this.
It's got the whole 3.5-hour show on there. So.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, they brought in Kerry, and Kerry was a draw because everybody brought in Kerry, dude. St. Louis, Missouri,
yeah.
The AWA, Kansas City, Florida. I mean, he went to Florida. He went Hawaii. He went. Kerry was one of the biggest in-demand wrestlers at that time.
And he was like the world champion. You know, like Ric Flair would go everywhere. He wasn't the world champion, but he was. You know, he was sought after like the world champion would be. No.
Yeah, and yeah, he would tour like the world champion, basically. I mean, he did leave. Everyone says he only stayed in Texas. Kerry went everywhere. He didn't stay. You know, it was more like one-shots here and there. But he did go everywhere. I mean, Kerry Von Erich, all the people who make fun of me for being such a Kerry Von Erich mark, if you grew up my age in Texas, you'd feel the same way about Kerry Von Erich. He was fucking the greatest thing since sliced bread.
If you never watched the stuff or you weren't there at the time, I don't think you can understand how big he was or why people liked him so much. But, I mean, if you just look at him in his later years, and not very good, but, I mean, you got to look at him.
We didn't have
time,
a foot, you
like,
know.
One of the most famous, definitely.
Yeah. He was the Hall of Fame?
Not the WWE. Is he in the Observer Hall of Fame?
No, because he had a 4-year run that was Hall of Fame worthy, but because the career was longer than 4 years, you know what I mean? He kind of, it works against him, unfortunately. I think he should, to me, okay, like a lot of people want to argue Sting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to get mad at me for saying this, but Kerry Von Erich did more in 3 years than Sting did in his entire career, okay? If Sting ever makes it into the Hall of Fame, Kerry Von Erich deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, you know? Because, and same thing with Junkyard Dog. The two of them are like, to me, those are equal. The two of them, they did so much in those 3 years that they should be in the Hall of Fame. But unfortunately, people want to say, oh, you got to do it for longer than 3 years. Well, if you drew more in 3 years than someone did drawing in 20 years, and they make it on the Hall of Fame as a draw, then in my opinion, fucking Kerry and Junkyard Dog and a few other people deserve the same fucking thing. You know what I mean? I mean, everybody talks about, okay, if you listen to the Dave shows throughout the year, 2 or 3 times a year, you're going to get Kerry Von Erich talk. Okay? People don't forget Kerry. People still remember Kerry, Junkyard Dog. You know, I think they're very worthy of being in the Observer Hall of Fame. But, you know, the criteria, and then, you know, they got to change the criteria, too, because nowadays, who's going to get in the Hall of Fame other than someone like John Cena or somebody? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, I make fun of Kerry a lot because I know you like him, and I just do that to fuck around with you. But I think it's amazing losing a foot how he was able to perform after that when he came back.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought that was
incredible. And we'll get to that on the Superclass 3. But the next match is, and I remember this match because it was the AWA Tag Team Champions, the Road Warriors, and they beat the Fabulous Freebirds, Gordian Hayes. And Gordian Hayes came to the ring with basically Road Warrior makeup on, but it was all Confederate flag.
Yeah.
So both their faces were Confederate flags.
People would,
and I don't think that
shit
would fly today. I think there'd be like Baltimore riots if they did that shit today, but
Jesus.
They look so fucking coolish. Michael Hayes, coolest wrestler who ever lived.
Yeah.
I mean, the dude was David Lee Roth of pro wrestling. You know?
Yeah, he was awesome. I remember this match because I think they tried to use a table in this match, but the table they chose to use weighed like 200 pounds, 300 pounds or something, so they couldn't hardly pick it up.
It was like the Big Show table where he blew himself up trying to get in. And then you had NWA Midget Champion Little Tokyo, and he pinned Little Mr. T. And Little Mr. T was basically a mini-me of Mr. T, and Little Tokyo was just this little He was a little taller than the other midgets, but just slightly. And he was all the stereotypical little Japanese midget wrestler, but he was actually pretty fucking awesome. I mean, he was great at his fucking job.
And also, he competed at WrestleMania 3. Remember that tag match?
Yeah.
It was Bundy and Lord Littlebrook in Little Tokyo against Hillbilly Jim, Little Beaver, and the Haiti Kid. And I just remember the classic line by Bob Uecker. What do you think about Little Beaver? He said, I think there's a lot of beaver around this place.
That, and then we witnessed Little Beaver's murder.
Oh, God.
I never
awesome.
Saw Little Beaver after killed. That match. I know he died.
I watched a match a few months ago where it was like in the summer of 87, and it was Hillbilly Jr. against a one-man gang. One-man gang getting to 747.
Oh, that's crazy. And then the next match is Jerry the Crusher Blackwell against Kamala in a body slam match. And this one, believe it or not, 9 minutes. That must have been a rib or something on these Well, you know what? Kamala, at this time, as big as he was actually in good shape and could move around.
He was doing leapfrog and stuff back then.
Yeah, this is when Kamala was still scary. You know, because you got the scary Kamala, and then all of a sudden you had the comedy Kamala. But
the comedy
Kamala
was managed by Slick.
Yeah. But before that, he was awesome. And then next match, AWA Junior Heavyweight Champion, Steve Regal, not that Steve Regal, but the Mr. Electricity Steve Regal. And he pinned Brad Ringan. And Brad Ringan has never, ever had any personality or anything, but he was actually a good worker in the ring. So I think I remember this being a good little match. Brad was always there. He was one of those guys
that
was always there.
Who was?
I'm sorry, what?
What'd you say?
I was saying he was always there. He was like one of the mainstays of the AWA from what I remember.
And I think he trained guys, too, didn't he? And he worked some
what?
In Japan. He worked a lot in Japan, too, I remember.
Yeah, and he's also been, like, a coach on some of the Olympic teams and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Byron was really into, like, the Olympic guys back then.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
AWA Junior Heavyweight title, I think only two people ever held that were Steve Regal, Buck Sumoff.
Yeah.
This must have been was this a break when Zumoff was up the river or something like this, that he was AWA Heavyweight Champion?
Either that or he was in world class.
That's right.
Yeah. Because those are the only places I remember him getting a push was world class and the AWA, because I remember he was a straight out jobber in WWF for a little while.
Mm-hmm. And, that's the name for you. I wish they would have had a camera in the courtroom when he tried to get away when they sentenced him to prison.
Yeah. And we can all thank Craig for booking our first ever child molester on the show.
Not only
that,
he was a
great interview, though. It was a good interview.
he still had that... He never progressed to the future. He still had that boombox from 1980, 1990, 1985.
With the equalizer and everything on
the
thing. Oh, man. And the thing you come out to rock and roll. What did he come out to? Oh, my God. Why can't I remember? Fuck, dude. I don't remember as soon as the show was over, but he always came out to, like, the same song, and it wasn't really that heavy rock and roll or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, Bug Grimhawk, dude. Anyway.
He came out in that Honky Tonk Man-like bodysuit.
Yeah. Like kind of an Elvis bodysuit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Him and Iceman were a good little tag team.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, the next match is Greg Gagne and Scott Hall. Magnum Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig. And they beat the Crippler Ray Stevens, Nick Bockwinkel, and Larry Zbysko. And I remember the Scott Hall of this era is so different than the Scott Hall that we knew, because this guy was just trying to look like a knockoff of Magnum TA or Magnum PI. Yeah. And he was real green, and he was pretty big. And I'll never forget Colonel DeBeer accusing him of doing steroids on a live interview.
I remember that.
That was fucking
it's
funny.
Like when Scott Hall, the thing was that mustache was holding him back, because when he shaved that, he suddenly became a good wrestler. You know, I don't know what
yeah.
it was.
yeah. And then Curt Hennig, this is when Curt Hennig was really coming into his own and becoming like an awesome worker that he became. And Ray Stevens, this is at the end of his career. And I've only seen him at the end, so it's like when I hear Dave and so many people talk about how great he was, it's kind of hard to believe it. But then again, he was wrestling from the 60s and shit, so there's so much we didn't see. But
yeah.
he's one, like, as far from his peers, everyone says he was the best, you know?
Yeah.
And like, say, we talked about Nick Bonkwinkle. Larry Zbysko was Vern's son-in-law, so he always kind of got pushed and was protected in the AWA. And I'm sure this is actually a good match. The next match, I guess this is like a half NWA show, because it's like there's so many NWA titles, like the NWA World Six-Man
yeah.
Tag Champs. Crusher Khrushchev, Ivan and Nikita Koloff, and they beat the Crusher, Dick the Bruiser, and Baron Von Roske. So you probably had a combined age of like 120 on one team. Joe and Ivan, you know, that's you're looking like 150 years. But I'm sure it was an entertaining match, and you know, Ivan and Nikita were awesome. You know, this is when Nikita was the Russian Road Warrior. Before he got off the
yeah,
juice and
yeah.
threw his hair out. Crusher Khrushchev, I just met him at fucking WrestleCon, and it's funny because I went to take a picture with him and Bill Eady. As them, they were wearing their makeup as Demolition, and Darso was talking to someone, so I kind of talked to Eady for a while, and then finally, like, Darso came to take the picture. And then when I was leaving, I was like, you know, I love Demolition, but goddamn, I wish you were in your... golfer gimmick so I could take a picture with you and then and he just kind of laughed at that, but yeah,
that was his WCW Saturday Night gimmick, right, where he'd
yeah.
come out. I mean, even one time, I think it was like in 1999 or something, he came out as Crusher Khrushchev again and I popped.
Yeah, and he was one of the Demolition, and he was a Repo Man, and he was Man Down Darso, and he was a Blacktop Bully, and I think it's between him and Brutus Beefcake, between most gimmicks for one person in a career. The next match is you have NWA World Champion Ric Flair pinning Magnum TA, and I'm sure that was a great match. And then the
yeah.
main event, you had the AWA World Champion Rick Martel, who was a champion for quite a long time. And he had before this, he was in the WWE as the tag team champion with Tony Garea. And then he came to AWA and got the championship. And then I'm trying to – it says, what the hell does DCO mean?
Double count out.
Oh, double count. Okay. So they went to a double count out in 230. So I'm assuming Stan refused to do the job because of the Japanese thing or whatever. And then he
yeah,
ended up beating Rick Martel later
this
for
was
the
a
title.
Very, they were probably running late. It's probably everybody wanted to go home.
That
they
is true. That is
3
true.
Minutes.
Yeah, yeah, and I think the whole relationship with Stan was like a debacle from the very beginning. They never should have put the title on him, honestly.
Yeah, he did. It was the thing like you were talking about Hogan earlier. You know.
Yeah.
Japan
yeah.
was his main thing. And, he was in a, and he was supposed to. He was the AWA World Champion. He was supposed to tour for Baba as the champion, and they were trying to get him to drop the belt to Nick Bockwinkel. And I think he still toured as AWA champion, even though he stripped him of the belt.
So, yeah.
And
then
he ran it
belt.
Over with his truck, and then he sent it back to him. And it's the last time we ever saw that big
yeah.
title belt.
Yeah. So then now we come into Super Clash number 2, and now we've
quite
gone
a
drop
off in matches here.
Yeah, and also a drop off in 17,000 people in the building.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but then this was 2 years later, though. because the first one was in 85.
Yeah.
So 87 to me is kind of like they're still hanging on, but you can tell it's coming. And this one you have Aldonel Casey, and he beat Bucks Doomhall in 10 minutes. That's amazing. That match went 10 minutes.
That's horrible.
You know, by today's standards, you know what I mean? You get the 10-minute Raw matches. And then the next match is DJ Patterson, who was okay. He died, right?
He died in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, in a motorcycle. And he was decent. He was here in Texas in San Antonio for a little bit. He was okay. Nothing spectacular. He was a good little hand. He wasn't bad. And then he wrestled the Super Ninja. And it has the Super Ninja's name, but this isn't Muda, right?
No.
I'm guessing it was Dave the Great Muda.
The Super Black Ninja.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Super Black Ninja. Okay. So, Takano. Dude, I know the name. I just can't think of who he's more famous as being. I'd have to think about it. I'm sure Shimp could tell us if he was on the show. But that one, 15th, it was a draw. And then he had Sherry Martel, and she pinned Medusa Michelli. Michelli? Am I saying that right? I don't think I am.
Yeah.
And this is when Medusa, you know, I guess that's why she just became Medusa, because her last name's kind of hard to pronounce. And this is when she was starting her run in AWA. And she had a good run in AWA. She managed some shitty wrestlers, but... you know, then she became a wrestler, and she actually got. She was better than the wrestler she managed. Honestly,
mm-hmm. She kind of took
she managed
Sherry left for the WWF.
Yeah, she took over when Sherry left. Yeah, and yep. she wrestled fucking Nails, before he became Nails, and got molested by Vince McMahon in that altercation. and one of the Kaninsky sons. But, yeah, that's when she was starting to come into her own. And then you have Kurt Hennig pinning Nick Bockwinkel to win the AWA World title. And I'm 26 minutes. I'm sure that was an awesome match. And
another one of these title changes that took place in the boardroom where the title was held up. The worst president of all time, Stanley Blackburn.
Yeah. Yeah, he was even worse than fucking the guy from WWE. I forgot his name. Yeah. And then the next match, you have the Midnight Rockers, who are probably the last great thing about the AWA, had Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty. And they teamed with Ray Stevens, and they beat Buddy Wolf, Doug Summers, and Kevin Kelly. So that's kind of
I'm
weird.
Thinking Buddy Wolf was supposed to be Buddy Rose, but they Buddy Rose left, so that's why they had Buddy Wolf.
That
and
or they just...
Yeah, Midnight
Rockers. Whoever wrote this might have put the wrong name. The what?
That's where they really got put on the map in the AWA.
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing because they were wrestling Doug Summers and Buddy Rose. And Buddy Rose is kind of a name, but Doug Summers was just a jobber for his whole fucking career. And goddamn,
yeah,
they were two of the ugliest, fattest dudes. Huh?
Yeah. I said they had some great matches, too. I remember that bloodbath they had in Las Vegas. I got that on DVD somewhere around here, on like one of my Shawn Michaels DVDs.
Yeah, that was a great match. I'd actually set the show for an hour, but we're probably going to go until the thing cuts us off here. But everyone else can hear that on the download. So just we're going to keep talking. If we lose air, just look for the download later, and we'll have a lot more. I should have set it for 90. I don't know why I set it for 60. Yeah, the Rockers were awesome. Marty got there first. I remember Marty was on the TV. And then he brought in Sean. This was right after Sean, or right when Sean was wrestling with Paul Diamond as the American Force in San Antonio. And then went on to bigger and better things at the Midnight Rockers. And the next match is Jerry Blackwell pinning Boris Zukov. Also, I don't know why they keep playing Jerry Blackwell in 10-minute matches. And so it's crazy. And the main event on here, which doesn't really sound like a main event, is you have Jimmy Snuka and Russ Francis. Russ Francis was a 49er, right?
Yeah, he competed in the Battle Royal at WrestleMania 2.
That's right.
He's
that's
one of the
right.
Football players there. And his dad, I think it was Edmund Francis, was a professional wrestler, I believe. So.
Oh, okay. I remember, like, San Francisco was like an AWA territory, so that's kind of where, I guess, the connection is. And they beat the Terrorist, who was Brian Knobbs, and the Mercenary, who was Ron Fuller. And
I'm trying to figure out how Ron Fuller ended up in the AWA.
Yeah, no kidding. And I really don't remember the Terrorist and the Mercenary at all, honestly. The only thing I really remember from Snuka in the AWA, besides kind of the beard going all racist on him, was him pushing Snuka off the top turnbuckle and him crashing to the ground and, like, breaking his leg in three places or something like that.
And he gave him the pile driver on the floor, and he, like, busted open. It's like when Ray Sabin gave him that pile driver in WWF. You remember seeing that?
Yeah, yeah. Didn't he give him, like, multiples, or was it just the one on the concrete?
I think it was just one. He used Carl DeBeers did that face-first pile driver. You remember?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I remember the weirdest thing. It was in 1986. This was in Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig were the tag team champions at the time, and they were wrestling Buddy Rose and Doug Summers. And Scott Hall was feuding with Colonel DeBeers. He came out there, and they didn't like his big four-way, and the referee's not paying attention. So he ran Scott Hall into the ring post, and he gets counted out, and the titles change hands. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
It's like I don't ever remember the titles being able to change on a count out. I guess it was politics, and that's the way they decided to do it or whatever. But, yeah, that was so weird. I was like, what the fuck is going on? I remember that as a kid. Like, I was confused as shit. I didn't know what was going on. But, yeah, and then he was kind of out of the territory not long after that. From what I remember.
I remember Colonel DeBeers. You remember Derek Dukes, that guy?
Yeah, yeah.
They would do these matches where the loser gets to paint the winner their skin color. Like, if Dukes won, he got to paint DeBeers black. If Dukes won, he got to paint him white.
You know, when you really think about it, wrestling is probably the most racist sport that ever was.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, people won't act like R-Truth doing a promo about his fighters as racist today. I mean, back then it was like, my God. You know?
Yeah, there was no such thing as politically correct in the 80s in pro wrestling.
Now people want to play racism because you got three black guys clapping their hands and dancing when they come out. They want to call it racist. You know, fucking stupid.
Yeah, that's crazy. I prefer the old days. And now we get to the most famous Super Clash, and I remember buying this on
pay-per-view. I watched
it on pay-per-view, and unfortunately, this fucking show caused me to have to go and get a fucking part-time job at Wendy's flipping burgers while I was going to high school because my mom was so goddamn pissed off at the fucking end of the Kerry Von Erich Jerry Lawler match. Kerry getting screwed that she swore she would never, ever spend a penny buying me a wrestling show again.
Well, and it was quite the mess, wasn't it? At the end
it was
of
what?
We'll get to that anyway.
So my mom was pissed. I remember I was pissed, and then I even got more pissed off when I had to get a job to buy all the damn WCW and WWE pay-per-views until I finally got me a box. You know, remember the magic boxes? And that was a sad day when the magic boxes no longer worked.
When was it? From 1999, during the Attitude Era, 1999-2000, we had a friend that he could produce, like, the magic DirecTV access cards, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
So where you could program on a computer and you put them in and everything's free. We had those.
Yeah, they'd be free, but then they would zap them and then you just had to redo it again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, right now, because I'm in my computer room and I have this old box fucking TV that I only occasionally watch, but it's on top of my dresser in my computer room. And my magic box is actually still on top of my TV. It's not connected to anything, but it's there. I'll probably keep it forever as a souvenir of the good old days. Oh, man. And so anyway, we're coming to, super, like I say, super class story. And looking back, this show sucked. I didn't think it sucked too bad when I was watching it, honestly. I guess because there were so many different people on the show. And
then when we were younger, we didn't think they sucked because we were just so happy to be watching them, I think.
Yeah, we're so happy to see wrestling and see different wrestlers that we don't normally get to see. And
back when the pay-per-views meant something, we were excited like five times of the year when they came out with the pay-per-view or something like that. I remember it was so awesome being able to watch them.
Well, to me, this pay-per-view brought out more anger and emotion out of me than any other pay-per-view I've ever seen in my life, honestly. But we'll get to that. The first match is you had Hector, Chavo, and Mondo Guerrero. Chavo would be Chavo Classic. And they beat Cactus Jack and the Rock and Roll RPMs. The Rock and Roll RPMs were one of a million Rock and Roll Express copycat teams. The only difference was, instead of finding two good-looking guys to put in the tag team, they found two of the ugliest motherfuckers they could find and put them in fucking... Rock and roll
bandanas.
Yeah, bandanas and bandanas, and goddamn, they were ugly.
And then Mike Davis went to the moon when he jumped off that scaffold with the bungee cord and found the moon rock when he was in Global.
He was awesome. He was actually awesome in Global at doing that gimmick.
Yeah,
but
he's playing a crazy man.
They were like if you had a scale of 1 to 10, and the Rock and Roll Express were number 10, they were number 1. And this is when Cactus Jack was skinny.
This was when he was first getting noticed. He was in Memphis that year. And remember, like, at the end of the year, ended up in World Class because he was feuding with Eric Embry and became the heaviest world light heavyweight champion.
And he was actually Cactus Jack Manson at the time because he kind of looked like Charles Manson. And I don't know if he was actually officially tagged into the match. He did do some spots. But basically the Guerreros, this is toward the end of their careers, but Chavo was great.
Chavo was always very good.
Yeah, he was always very good. He's one of the first people I saw do the moonsaults to actually do a correct moonsault, because I think Tiger Mask did more of a side moonsault, kind of like an angle. And Chavo was the first one I remember doing the perfect backflip. Hector was good. Hector had some good fire. He was a little skinnier. I guess he's most famous for being the Goggly Gooker. And also
Lasertron,
one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Lasertron had those little things on his mask on top. Like, on, like, little...
Dave used to put in the Observer back in. He called him Hectortron.
Oh, but Lasertron was awesome. Mondo was good. He was decent. He was the smallest of the three, the less famous of the three, but he was good. He's probably most famous for training the gorgeous ladies of wrestling.
Yeah.
And I remember there's a story where he actually choked the shit out of one of the girls who wasn't paying attention or something to get his point across. I'll never forget. I remember when I was watching Southwest, and this is around when Southwest was working with Georgia. And they're having a big co-show, and they kept advertising Mondo Guerrero. And I'm like, oh, wow, this other Guerrero is going to be awesome. And they pushed him and pushed him, you know, average in the weeks. And then he makes his big debut on the show against the Turk Ali Baba, who was a short, fat, barefoot guy who was actually pretty awesome. And, okay, but he was a jobber. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, Mondo's going to win. He's going to look great. And he looked good. It was a good little match. But it was a draw, and I was like, what? They've been advertising it for weeks, and he had a draw with a fucking loser. What the fuck? But, you know, but he was okay. And this match was okay because the Guerreros were nonstop, basically. And basically Cactus and the RPMs were just bumping for them the whole time. And it was decent. It was just 6 minutes, so it's not like it was like... All these matches are short if you look at them, looking at them now. The next match was Eric Embry. And he beat Jeff Jarrett. This is a very young Jeff Jarrett, where he I think he'd broken out for a couple of years in Memphis, but he wasn't as good as he became. He was still coming up. And Eric Embry was like the booker of World Class. I think it was the World Class Junior title they were wrestling for or something.
Yeah, and Jeff Jarrett him and Eric Embry got it. Jeff Jarrett was pretty, he started in 86, and he was pretty good, in the first couple of years, he was actually, you know, really good.
Yeah,
for being
yeah.
so young.
Yeah, and then, and Eric Embry, at this point, he had gained some weight. And so I remember a very young Eric Embry in Southwest feuding with, the Sheep Herders. It was, the Sheep Herders against
yeah.
Eric Embry, and what other jobber they teamed with Eric Embry. And he'd always look good, and then the jobber would always lose. He was, the most pushed jobber in Southwest until Manuel Villalobos took over. And then he went heel, and then he teamed with the Fabulous Blondes with Ken Sims?
Yeah.
I'm not too sure, but... They were a decent little team, and then he had his run in World Class where, you know what, he got a pick when it happened, when he won control of World Class, and it kind of became mm-hmm. USWA. But I was just so disgusted in watching them tear that banner.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, how did that banner become the thing for the bag? It was just like, I just watched that, and I was like, I was done with Texas wrestling. I mean, Global was cool when it came out, but I was kind of done. I mean, and this was when I was in high school, had football practice after school, so it's not like I would rush home to watch it, so I kind of stopped. But it was like watching that, it was just like, fuck you. You know what I mean? That
mm-hmm.
I took that way too seriously when they tore that banner up.
And actually, if you go to my YouTube channel, I have that entire feud with him and Devastation from the beginning till they had that last match and pulled down the banner.
Right?
Yeah, PY Too High, Phil Hickerson.
He became a Japanese synthesizer. Everyone's became a different kind of synthesizer for all these different countries. Yeah, and then the next match is your favorite wrestler in the world, the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant. And he pinned Wing Bloom in 24 seconds. So basically, this whole match was just a boogie woogie man boogieing to the ring and being the boogie woogie man.
Punches and then the hitting an elbow.
Yeah. Wing Bloom was one of the
Beverly Brothers.
One of the Beverly Brothers with Mike Enos, and they also wasn't it the new Minnesota Wrecking Crew too?
Yeah, the Minnesota Wrecking Crew, too. That's when they were under masks. You remember?
Yeah.
It was at the same time they were still the AW World Tag Team Champions. And I guess they weren't getting... Burn wasn't doing very many shows. This was in 1990. And they came in against the Steiners under masks. He knew who it was. I mean,
yeah.
My God. The worst kept secret of wrestling. It's when you saw Doom with the mask on, you knew who that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they came in and worked with the Steiners for a little while and just did job mostly.
Yeah. And then the next match is you have the World Class Championship Texas Champion, Iceman King Parsons, and he pinned Brickhouse Brown. I'm assuming this is when the Iceman had gone bad. I never dug the Iceman after he went bad. To me, he didn't work as a heel to me. It killed him for me being a heel. I mean, he was awesome as a babyface, but once he went heel, it didn't work, even though he did it for years. And Brickhouse Brown was been around forever, and all kinds of stories about Brickhouse Brown being a dirty person, a dirty, stinky person. I hope that's not being racist, but that's just the stories I've heard about him. But it was okay. But, yeah, I just could never get into King Parsons as a heel.
And that's the Rock did not coin the term Rudy Pooh. That came from Iceman King Parsons.
Yeah, Mama says it be that way sometime.
Yeah, and I remember when he was feuding with Savannah Jack, and he was running around. And he had a noose. It was half of it was black and half of it was white. He was feuding with Savannah Jack, and he threw Oreos at him because he said he was black on the outside and white on the inside.
Oh my God, wrestling was so awesome back in the day. So awesome. And then we got the next match, which Ricky Rice, Derek Dukes, and Wendy Richner, and they beat Bad Company. Was it Bad Company? Paul Diamond, Pat Tenanta,
yeah,
and Medusa Michelli. When Richter pinned Michelli. And what the fuck were there? The Top Guns, right?
The Top Guns, yeah.
Yeah, Top Guns, Ricky Rice and Derek Dukes. And I didn't think they were too bad. I think they're okay. Derek Dukes ended up becoming a boxer, and he lost to
Mark Gastineau.
Mark Gastineau, that's right. I think he was...
He took a dive.
He took a dive, yeah, to Mark Gastineau. I just remember Mark Gastineau beat all these tomato cans, and then he beat someone the shit out of him when he fought a real fighter.
It was like his first boxing match or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was a football player, and was he on some reality show?
I don't remember, honestly. I think he was a Raider. I just remember he beat all these tomato cans, and then he finally fought a decent fighter, and the dude beat the shit out of him bad. Yeah. Okay, then the next match is Greg Gagne, and he beat Ronnie Garvin by a count-out. So I guess in AWA he could win that by a count-out because he won the AWA TV title. The thing with Ron Garvin, he just like the Iceman, he didn't work for me after he went heel. Like, he was so awesome as a babyface, fighting the Horsemen, and him and Ric Flair just beating the shit out of each other. And then he won the championship. It didn't really work. And then not too long after that, they made him go heel. And for some reason, it just never worked for me as a heel. When he was a babyface, I thought he was awesome.
Ron Garvin, this was when he was coming back to drop the title because he just signed with the WWF at the time, which is why it was the count out.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. And then I remember he had a pretty. They didn't. He kind of had. His WWE run wasn't that great, and then they ended up making him a referee. But he was actually old by that time, even though he didn't look it.
Yeah, he was. I always thought it was wild to me when I found out that Jimmy Garvin was actually his stepson. Oh, that was strange.
Yeah.
Apparently, Mark Gastineau has a son, and he had a son with actress Brigitte Nielsen. Remember that name?
Yeah, that's Red Sonja.
She was in Rocky IV.
In
Rocky IV.
Yeah, she was the Russian. She was Lana in Rocky IV.
Yeah. And she was also married to Sylvester Stallone. And then she hooked up with Flavor Flav. Remember that?
Yeah, on the reality show. She was also in Cobra. Was it Cobra with Sylvester Stallone? She was in a couple of Sylvester Stallone movies.
Yeah, she was in Cobra. She was in, Red Sonja?
Yeah, Red Sonja. Like female Conan was basically what
Beverly,
Red Sonja was.
Beverly Hills Cop 2, maybe? I think she
was
in Beverly Hills Cop
2. Yeah, she was Beverly Hills Cop. She was, goddamn, she was hot. She was kind of like, she was like Anna Nicole Smith, but without the big tits, but the, you know, the long, beautiful legs. She was all legs. I remember that. She was hot.
Mark Gastineau had his ex-wife and their daughter had a reality show on E! Entertainment Television show called The Gastineau Girls.
I actually never even heard of that. Wow.
I remember hearing something about that. So.
And then the next match is one of the greatest matches in the history of pro wrestling, and that was the Street Fight Lingerie Battle Royal that I guess they got Vince Russo from Alone. And the Syrian Terrorist won, and I'm not sure who the Syrian Terrorist was, but she was pretty charismatic. I don't remember her very long other than this match and was it Powell?
Mm-hmm. Powerful woman of wrestling or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really when I remember her. But other people were, of course, Bambi. Bambi around forever. Peggy Lee Leather, she's always been around forever. Laura Lynn, I'm trying to think of who that was. Brandy May. Brandy May is probably the the farmer's daughter, I'm guessing. Malibu.
Didn't she die recently?
I think you might be thinking of another farmer's daughter type girl from Glow.
I swear I read that somewhere.
I'm thinking this is a different one. There were so many farmer's daughters, you know. Nina, Pocahontas, and Luna Vachon, probably the biggest name on there.
I want to say Nina is Ivory.
Maybe. I have to go back and watch that thing on your YouTube channel, because the main thing I remember is that the farmer's daughter in this battle royal was the hottest chick out of all of them. I mean, this chick was beautiful. And you got an awesome Basic Instinct shot of her in the match when she's fighting the terrorist. And I remember just being a kid and seeing that Beaver shot and being like, God damn, that was the greatest thing ever.
I want to know how this ended up on the Vern Gagne show. A lingerie
right,
battle royal.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Well, there were many promoters